In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about Mexico and exploring some of its long and rich history and culture, and certainly talking about the relationship between Mexico and the United States. And our guest is Earl Shores. He is a journalist, lecturer, novelist, social critic. He's the author of a number of books, including Under the Fifth Sun, a novel of Pancho Villa, a book looking at Latino Americans, which is entitled Latinos, A Biography of the People, and a number of other books. He's received the National Humanities Medal and also the Mexican Order of the Aztec Eagle. And he's the author of a new book that certainly reflects his very long-standing interest in Mexico, its history and culture. The title of his book is The Life and Times of Mexico, and it's published by W.W. Norton. It is out now if you'd like to look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, that's 800-222-9455. So, again, locally, 333-9455. That's the number to use if you're here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Questions, comments are welcome. All we ask is people are brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But anybody's welcome to call. Mr. Shores, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm glad to be there.
You grew up, did some of your growing up at least, on the border region between Mexico and the United States. And so your interest in at least some experience with Mexico goes back really to the time that you were a kid, right?
Yes, from the time we moved to the border from Chicago when I was about five or six, I guess, somewhere around there.
So when you were a boy, what about Mexico did you find interesting?
I think I learned very early on something about Mexico and history. And as I wrote in the very beginning of the book, my father and I used to go across the border every Saturday from Douglas, Arizona to Agua Prieta. And we went there because it was during World War II and gasoline was available in Mexico and not very available in the United States. And while he fiddled with the car and filled it up with gasoline and so on, I wandered around and I became friends with an old man who sat in front of his house on Saturday mornings, and we spoke in first in sort of English, and then as I learned Spanish, in a mix of Spanish and English. And he talked about the history of Mexico, the great battle that Pancho Villa had fought there at Agua Prieta, and I became fascinated with Mexico and with Pancho Villa, and eventually wrote a long novel about Pancho Villa. So it's in my bones.
Well, it's certainly, you know, one of the things, for good or ill, that separates the United States from a lot of other countries is our youth. We do not have thousands of years of history to think about, to draw on, to be shaped by. But certainly in the case of Mexico, we do have a long, rich history. And I think one of the important points that you make is that if you're going to understand Mexico today, you need to have some kind of understanding of Mexican history, because everything about Mexico today is shaped by what happened when Europeans came and met and subjugated, absorbed, combined with the indigenous people and the cultures that were there when they got there.
Yes. The United States and Mexico are different in that both had indigenous populations when the Europeans arrived in what is now the United States. The people were killed. There were just massacres, a case of genocide. So that the indigenous people have less influence here. In Mexico, there were also great slaughters of people. People died from disease that was brought from Europe, for which they had no resistance. And there were great killings and the misuse of people. But there was also great intermarriage between the Europeans and the Mexicans. And the Mexicans meaning those people who lived in what is now Mexico City, their real name is Mexica, from an Aztec god whose name was Mestli. So these early Mexicans or Aztecs and other indigenous peoples intermarried, and a different kind of history then evolved. The indigenous people of what is now Mexico, Mesoamerica, were different from the people in the north. Mesoamerica was one of the five original civilizations in the history of the world. And the Mesoamericans were people who in the Yucatan, the Maya, learned to use the concept of zero long before it was used in Europe. They had developed a system of alphabetic writing, one of only three civilizations in the world to do that. So it was a very sophisticated civilization that the Spaniards encountered when they entered Mesoamerica. And I should tell you that with Miguel León Portilla, who is the president of the Colegio Nacional in Mexico and emeritus at UNAM, which is the National Autonomous University, we've done a book called In the Language of Kings, which is a long, I'm afraid, sort of heavy to lift, at least, anthology of Mesoamerican literature. It was a great, great civilization. And it has made an enormous difference in what's happened to Mexico over its history and in the present.
Well, that's, I think that here's a real important point that you make. That is that Mexican culture, as it exists today, is very much a process of this blending of the indigenous culture and European culture, and that is something that, and do correct me if I'm wrong about this, but that is something that is, that seems to be by and large considered a plus by people in Mexico. The idea is that there's something that is special that's come as a result of this hybrid of the two.
Yes, I think that's generally the way it is. It certainly enriched the country and the culture. At the same time, the mestizaje, as it's called, mestizo means mixed, and the mestizaje is the mixture of people. So the mestizaje, which is really quite wonderful, it produces a person of two cultures and so on, also produces a serious problem in Mexico, which is interesting, I think. The Mexican who's mestizo, and most Mexicans, as you say, are, has two sides. One is a European side, and that came down from Spain, and it's criollo. The criollos are the people who are all European, although they're born in Mexico. And then it has an indigenous side. And because the Europeans conquered Mexico after they invaded, the European side thinks of itself as superior. And the indigenous side, which I think is every bit the equal of the European side, feels in many ways inferior. And this whole business began very early on, in the very early 18th century, when Clavijero wrote his first history of ancient Mexico. He began to speak of the ancient Mexicans, that is, those people we've been talking about, the Aztecs and the Maya, as a great civilization. And then Clavijero cut it off when the Spaniards arrived and said the current indigenous people are lazy, shiftless, what people always say when they have a racist view. So what we have in Mexico now is the mestizaje, in which the two sides of the person are at war. One side thinks of itself as better than the other side. The other side reacts by saying that side is not very good. And there is within the Mexican soul this terrible, difficult conflict, which at the same time, as you say, is the strength and the beauty of Mexico.
Hmm. Well, you do something interesting in the book as a way of structuring it, paying some as a sort of a nod to the way that the Aztec thought about where the centers of power, the important parts of the body were, and associated that with things like emotion and intellect and so forth.
Yes.
You divide the book into sections where you use that metaphor to talk about politics, history, culture, and so forth. And just for a second, if we grab onto that metaphor a little bit more and we think, and this is, in a lot of ways, it's a terrible overgeneralization, but if you do think about the fact that countries and civilizations can and do have personalities, how would you describe the personality of Mexico?
Well, I would, at the risk of repeating myself, say that it's conflicted. I think that the indigenous side and the European side have both produced a kind of wonderful hospitality or generosity or both in the people. It was the style of the indigenous people, and when the Europeans came, they just vied with each other to show who was the most generous, the most prosperous, and so on. So there is, it's really quite wonderful hospitality and friendliness in Mexico, which I suppose is why so many tourists go to Mexico. It's an awfully nice place. The people are nice. There are several aspects to the personality. Indigenous people feel oppressed. If one has dark skin, like as many indigenous people do, it's very difficult to get a taxi to stop for you in Mexico City, just as it would be for an African American in New York. On the other hand, the criollos have come into power politically. They did that in the 1980s. For a time, the mestizos really were in power in Mexico, and now, since the 80s, the criollos are very much in control of Mexico, and they tend to be more conservative politically and so on. So we see this mixed character, the wonderful generosity that comes from both sides, the great hospitality, and then we see the results of the conflict. So we see some violence in Mexico, terrible violence toward women in Mexico, just absolutely intolerable violence against women. And we see the business of machismo arising. It's a very complex notion. Machismo has a lot to do with how the world sees one. And machismo comes from being conquered for the most part. If you can't do anything in the outside world, if you have no power at all, then you may as well be a tough guy at home. And it produces a great deal of problems, a great many problems. Oppression is a bad business.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Earl Shores, he is a journalist and a writer. He's authored a novel about Pancho Villa, as he mentioned, titled Under the Fifth Sun. He's also done a book about American Latinos, titled Latinos, A Biography of the People, and also that collection that he put together of ancient indigenous literature of Mexico in the language of kings and other books. So you can certainly head to the library, the bookstore, if you're interested in sampling some of his writing, including this new one, The Life and Times of Mexico. It's just out. It's published by W.W. Norton. We do have a caller here, and other people who are listening are invited into the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, I'd read in some places that the ancient Mexicans didn't use the wheel. But then again, I've also seen evidence that maybe they made toys that used wheels. So anyway, I was wanting to know if you had any knowledge as to what their use of the wheel might have been, pre-Columbian.
Oh, I think you're quite right. There were toys that had wheels, but the wheel wasn't used because there were no beasts of burden. There were no animals to pull carts or whatever. So other methods were used, logs.
Well, when they were building pyramids and things like that, did they?
There were no wheels and no beasts
wheels.
Of burden. No, it was all human labor. The cow, the goat, and so on didn't come to Mexico until after the invasion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
all right. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Early on in the section where you're writing about first about the indigenous cultures and then about the comings of the Europeans, I think particularly when you write about what happened to the Aztecs, you write something along the lines of, you know, this just shouldn't have happened this way. When you look at the fact that we had this very large, well-established indigenous culture with a very strong warrior tradition, and here we had this very small group of interlopers. Maybe their military technology was a little bit superior, but they were certainly outnumbered. One has to ask the question, what happened here? How is it that the small number of Spaniards managed to bring down this huge, sprawling, powerful old empire?
It is interesting. There's a theory floating around the world in a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel or something. It says those were the three aspects that defeated the indigenous peoples. I think that's not entirely correct. What happened is that Cortes came to Mexico. He was a lawyer. He had no military training, and he had this small group with him. Moctezuma made some mistakes in dealing with Cortes. The worst was to show him gold, which really set Cortes to thinking he should conquer the country. What was fascinating is that the Mexica, the people who we call the Aztecs, had control of a great deal of Mexico, of Mesoamerica. There was really sort of Aztec hegemony. Aztec is a word that didn't appear until the 19th century. So these people really had conquered other peoples and took tribute from them. So Cortes, being a very shrewd fellow, met the Tlaxcalans on his way to what he thought was a golden city somewhere. And after a terrible massacre of the Tlaxcalans and the destruction of their temples and so on, Cortes allied himself with them. And the Tlaxcalans had been for many years under the thumb of the Aztecs, the people from Tenochtitlan. And so they were glad to join Cortes. So here came Cortes with his little band and a few horses and some terrifying dogs and so on. And he allied himself with a very large nation at Tlaxcala. So when he entered Mexico the first time, he had the Tlaxcalans with him. He was there for a while. Committed some atrocities and then was driven out of Mexico by the Aztecs. And then he returned with a vast army of people who had been under the thumb of the Aztecs of Mexico City. So he, when he finally took on the great Aztec armies, he outnumbered them 30-40 to 1. So it was a political maneuvering that enabled Cortes to defeat the Mexicans. It was brilliant political maneuvering with a little help from smallpox.
Well, the other thing I think is sort of interesting is that in addition, as part of his entourage, he had a woman who served as a translator and perhaps also an advisor, whose name now in Mexico has come down to be synonymous with treason.
Yes, Namalinche.
Namalinche. And which sort of suggests, you know, one wonders to what extent people in Mexico think of the fact that what happened was maybe not the natural order of things, and something about it was, you know, without a fifth column, you know, the Spaniards couldn't have done what they did, and somehow it was the country in some way betrayed itself.
Yes, I think that's correct. What's interesting to me about Mexico and the way I've structured this book is that the history is very long, and in order to help people through the history and to relate the history to the moment, what I've tried to do is in every chapter in this book to begin with something that's happening now or happened in the recent past, months or a couple of years ago, and then to relate it to the history. So as we move forward through the history of Mexico from where you and I have begun this morning with Mesoamerica, we see what's happened in this time as well as in that time. If we're talking about the Maya, there's a conversation with a young fellow who's going to become a doer, and men, that's the Maya word, it's H M-E-E-N, men. He's going to become a priest in the old Maya way right now. So the Maya are still there. Similarly, if we're going to deal with further on with questions of economics, I've spent a long time with the old prostitutes of the Plaza Loreto, and I don't know if you got to that point in reading through the book, but these are old women. They're nearly as old as I am, and some in their late 50s, 60s, and 70s who work as prostitutes. And you can see the whole story of what's happened to the economy of Mexico through these ladies. They're very old, and they work for very little money, and their customers, oddly enough, are all very young. And these are all young men from the countryside who come to Mexico City who don't have enough money to have a girlfriend, who can barely survive on the day wages they earn, if they earn money at all, who certainly couldn't go to an expensive streetwalker or whatever. So you see the economy of the country, the suffering of the people in the countryside, the way they come to the city, what they're able to do in the city, all through these, what I call the respectful divas of the Plaza Loreto. And I think, I hope that's the way to look at a country with a long history, is to always connect the moment to the past. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, I think so, very much so. Well, I have several callers here who'd like to join in the conversation, so we'll just do that. Someone listening in Bloomington, Illinois this morning, so we'll go there first, and he's first in line on line four.
Yes,
hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hey, I'm just wondering, the countries that Spain conquered in Central and South America, they all seem to be economically much worse off than Spain is itself. It'd probably be cynical to say that Spain, its main export is poverty, but what the standard of living of the average Mexican compared to the standard of living of the average Spaniard? Any ideas?
Yes, it sort of goes up and down. There have been times when Spain was in economic trouble near the end of the Franco regime and shortly afterward, when Spaniards were coming to Mexico because there was more opportunity, etc. But right now, however, I think you're exactly right. Spain is just booming, and Mexico suffers a terrible problem of poverty, and it's all through Latin America. I think you're exactly right, it will take a long time to solve it, and it's not certain that Mexico, which was having a boom in the 1950s, what the Mexicans called the Age of Gold, Época de Oro, it's past now, and it has something to do with government policy, no doubt, and with the vast population growth in Mexico. There are 100 million or more Mexicans. Very difficult to find work for them, to produce goods for them. It's just it's really an awful problem.
So you couldn't say there's something in this Spanish culture that, I mean, all the poverty throughout South and Central America, is it too far past the original conquerors to say it's a link to the Spanish culture? It's something more complicated than that.
Well, I think that we've been talking about some of the complications that ensued from the invasion of the Americas by the Spaniards, but it's certainly a part of this invasion and what it's left behind, but it's also at least in Mexico, which I know best, in Mexico it's been a terrible problem of population growth. Mexico is just filled with people. In the 1950s, Mexico City had about 1.5 million people. There are now somewhere between 26 and 29 million people in the market area around Mexico City. The other problem that's happened all through Latin America is that people have left the farms, the rural areas, and come to the cities. In Mexico, it's been the centralization. That is, all these people coming to Mexico City, where somewhere between a fourth and a third of the entire population lives. And they're not prepared. They don't have the skills needed to live in the city, and the city doesn't have jobs for them, and so on. However, rural poverty, and I spend a lot of time in rural areas, rural poverty is a nightmare, just a nightmare in Mexico. People living on 85 cents a day.
You couldn't attribute the population growth? Is that because of the strong ties to the Catholic Church? Because in Spain, they don't seem to have that population problem, yet they're as much Catholic as they are in Mexico. Yeah.
One would think so, and I think when you first look at it, you say that's the church. But I've talked to many Mexicans who know the country very well. My friend Ifigenia Martinez, who's one of the grand women in Mexican politics, is an economist, and it's not the church, as it isn't the church. You're right, certainly in Spain and in Italy and so on. It's the culture. It's the Mexican culture. The men feel that they want to have children to show that they're very manly. And it's also the rural aspect of Mexico that still exists. It's people thinking that wealth is in the number of children to work the farm. That has to do with an agricultural society. And the population growth is just falling like crazy in Mexico now. It's down to 1.6 or 1.7 now, which is going to stabilize the population at last.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and our guest is Earl Shoris. His book is The Life and Times of Mexico, and it is just out here. It's published by W.W. Norton. He's a journalist, has also authored a novel about Pancho Villa, a nonfiction book about Latinos in the United States entitled Latinos, A Biography of the People. And you can look for the book now. It's out there in bookstores. Questions, comments, too, are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's continue here, and I think we have another caller in Chicago, line number one.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning. The way you describe the organization of your book is really fascinating, and I think it would really appeal perhaps to younger readers and pull them in and maybe be effectively used in high school or college courses. At least I hope so. I have a question that...
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have a question that pushes your history along a little bit. I'm the period with Emilio Zapata and Pancho Villa. I am really confused about that. You can imagine how much information I had about that in American history and world history here in the States. So if you could talk about exactly what was the purpose, because if my understanding, that was sort of an agrarian revolution to push the other earlier revolution along. So if you could just explain that aspect of history. And also, what type of accommodation was occurred with the United States? Because I know that the United States sent in reinforcements to hunt down Pancho Villa because they felt that that revolution was very threatening. So if you could clear up the fog of that period in Mexican history for me, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, I'll do it as quickly as I can. That's a good question, and a person could write a book about it. Anyway, here's what happened in 1910. Mexico had been under the thumb of Porfirio Diaz, who had been in the president's chair for 35 years. He was clearly a dictator. What happened then is the Mexicans, led by a man named Madero, made an effort to unseat this man. It was a no re-election platform that Madero was working on. In various parts of Mexico, various groups arose in support of this anti-re-election campaign. It's called the Mexican Revolution of 1910, but it was much more a series of civil wars than a revolution. It had no real program as a revolution has or it must have, and I'm not the only one who thinks that. All the great Mexican historians hold that view. What happened then is with someone like Emiliano Zapata, it was about land. He was from Morelos. He was literate. He was not at all like the fellow in the movie about Zapata. And he led, you're quite right, a sort of agrarian movement. People just wanted to take their land back. And they said they're still there. I've been in those towns and talked to people, and they don't have the land back. In the north, there were two distinct groups. In the northwest, there was a group which was led essentially by school teachers. They were quite educated. They were very anti-church, very anti-Catholic, and they came down from the north. In the sort of center north of the country, Pancho Villa, who was poorly educated, and another group, the wise man in the group was the governor of Chihuahua, Abraham Gonzalez. Villa became more sophisticated over time, and his group was made up of small farmers, ranchers, some peasants, and they formed a great army. Villa was a great warrior. He was eventually defeated by a man from the northwest, Obregón, who later became president. So this is what happened in the revolution, and very, very briefly, as I'm telling it. And the United States was involved in various ways. It's clear that the American ambassador to Mexico, a man named Henry Lane Wilson, helped to overthrow Madero and really to lead toward his assassination. The United States then sided with Pancho Villa. Wilson was very much on Villa's side. Then as the civil wars went on, the United States changed and sided with people from the Northwest, a man named Carranza, called himself the first chief. And when Wilson turned against Villa, he aided Carranza. Villa later became very angry, and he crossed into the United States at Columbus, New Mexico, raided Columbus, New Mexico. I think 19 people were killed. And that's when the United States sent Pershing and the American troops into Mexico, chasing after Villa. The United States during this period also landed troops on the east coast of Mexico, and there was some to do about that. So So the United States played a great role in the change in Mexico, really determined who would rule Mexico. And the American presence in Mexico has been enormous economically, politically, socially, culturally, ever since.
I have one final question.
Sure.
It seems like this period has pretty much set up the myth for modern Mexico. In Mexico, there's so many things that's named after Madero or Obregón, and I'd just like your opinion of that. I mean, every country has its myths of its political history and how it was shaped, and it seems to me that this period in history, whether it had the results that the people wanted or not, it sort of set the norm.
Yeah, Mexico has several periods that are very important. The pre-Hispanic period of Mesoamerica was very important. There was then the invasion and the conquest. Then there was the Mexican fight for independence, from which we get the Grito on September 16th and so on. Benito Juarez was a very important figure. We got Mexico changed under Benito Juarez, who unfortunately led into Diaz. We then have this period of civil war or revolution. And then there was a brief period where the French occupied Mexico and Juarez finally defeated Maximilian and he was executed and so on. But it is a sort of a foundation. It's not the foundational myth, but it's certainly the period of great importance in Mexico. As you say, it's a basic. Every political party that's been in power up until the year 2000 had the word revolution in its name. In 2000, a party defeated those parties with revolution in their name, and we saw a change in Mexico as it moved toward democracy. The change has been very difficult for the Mexicans, and I think over time, over the next 6, 12, 18 years, we'll see Mexico become a democratic society.
Yeah. Just to follow up on that, just give you a chance to talk about that a little bit more, and I realize we've been jumping around a lot in time.
Yes.
But as you say, in 2000, Vicente Fox was elected president. And this was breaking the long power of the PRI,
yes.
The Revolutionary Institutional Revolutionary Party, is that right?
Right, Partido Revolucionario Institucional.
And they had been essentially running the country since the 20s, something
yes,
like
that? Yes, the party was formed a little later, but it came out of Obregón and then Calles and so on. So the party had different names over time. People were always changing the way the party operated. And by the 30s, it had become this powerful corporatist institution. Corporatist not meaning that it had a lot of corporations in it, but that it functioned like a corporation. It had the military, it had business people, and it had the unions as the three parts of the party. So it's pretty hard to oppose a party that had those three sections.
So after this very long period of time in which the PRI was the ruling party, here finally the first opposition president, Vicente Fox, and his party, the Alliance for Change, as you
right.
say, the first time we don't have a party that has revolution in its name.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people would have said this was indeed revolutionary, the fact that he won. And although some people might say that it had been coming for some time, you know, slowly, so maybe there was some sort of inevitability about that.
I'm just going to
invite you to talk a little bit about just how things have, to what extent things have changed as a result of Mr. Fox being elected the president.
Yeah. The changes that Fox proposed had to do with what he called modernizing the economy, making it much more conservative in its political views, that is, selling off utilities and so on. Almost none of Fox's programs have been instituted. The reason for that is that the Mexican Congress is still controlled by the old PRI. Fox is connected with a PAN, which means bread, and it's the Partido Acción Nacional. And that was a party that was given a boost in the 1930s by the United States, which wanted to see some sort of opposition there. He was elected. He ran against a very weak candidate, and he ran really in the lee of Salinas de Gortari. Salinas, who was the darling of the United States, and he was on the cover of Time and so on. Salinas was just a terrible crook, and he left great problems behind in Mexico, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is no boon to Mexico and the farmers and so on. So it was a very weak PRI, and then along came this man saying, I will bring democracy to Mexico. And he did, in fact, bring what sophisticated Mexicans now call an alternation, that is, one party changed and another one took power. Whether that alternation will continue, we don't know. I suspect that it will, but there will be a period of 6, 12, 18 years, as I say, of settling down. The Mexican president is elected for one term only, for 6 years. So Fox is coming to the end of his term. He's just been hogtied by the Congress, so his government has not been successful, and Mexicans will either go back to the PRI, or they will look to the third party, the Democratic Revolutionary Party, which is somewhat to the left of the PRI, and has a very charming and interesting candidate named López Obrador. So we'll have to see which way the country goes. At the moment, the PRI doesn't have a very interesting candidate. López Obrador is a very charming fellow, and the PAN, the PAN, which is the party that Fox belongs to, it's really sort of in disrepute. So my guess is it will be between the PRI and the PRD. In the polls in Mexico, everyone says that López Obrador is now the people's choice, the 2 years before the election. The PRI is very strong in the countryside and so on. I think it would be extremely difficult for López Obrador to be elected.
We have a couple of other calls. We're trying to get at least one more. DeWitt County, line 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. First, to jump back a few more centuries again, about the Aztecs, and you're talking about the indigenous people who the Aztecs demanded tribute from. Well, the Aztecs themselves were not indigenous. They came from western Mexico, and one of the first acts they did when they settled in Mexico City was they married one of the local princesses and skinned her alive and wore her skin and demanded thousands. The tribute they demanded was thousands of people to have their beating hearts ripped out of their chests. So you can imagine why people were willing to side with Cortez. But to jump forward again, in Catholic martyrology, we read about so many priests who were executed by the state in Mexico in the 20s or 30s for celebrating Mass and for being priests. Can you explain why that was?
Yes.
And I'll hang up.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Yeah.
Yes. I think, yes, that's exactly what happened when the people arrived either from the West, from Aslan, which might have been in the West, or may very well have been in what's currently the Southwest of the United States. The linguistic evidence says that that's probably where they were. They then took quite a beating and were put off on an island where they had nothing to eat but rattlesnakes. And those people, the Chichimeca, who came down, who became the Aztecs, came from Aztlan, were a tough bunch. they didn't demand tribute immediately. The sacrifice of human beings grew over time. After 1325, when they arrived in what's now Mexico City, other questions about the priests are difficult and in some ways very difficult for Roman Catholics to deal with. Mexico was controlled to some extent by the church, which had most of the money and a great deal of the land in Mexico. And the priests were often very corrupt. Priests married, had children, owned property, and so on. Hidalgo, who led Mexico to independence, was a priest and also a very good businessman and quite a dancer and a man who had a good time in life. The people from the Northwest were very angry with the church because of what it had taken in property in Mexico and so on. And what you saw in the 20s and 30s was really a result of this past in which the anti-clerical laws in Mexico started in the 19th century, and the Ley Lerdo was the strongest anti-clerical law, and that's why priests couldn't appear in their priestly costume in the streets, or even with their collars turned round in the streets in Mexico. Yes, churches were desecrated, priests were killed. There was in the 1930s what was called a Cristero Rebellion. Those were people who were very, very conservative, connected to the church, and there was a sort of war between the government and the Cristeros. And that's more or less ended. Mexico has come closer and closer and closer to the church now. And there are a lot of pictures in the life and times of Mexico, and one of the last pictures in the book is of Vicente Fox, who went to the university in Mexico City, the Jesuit university, thought of becoming a priest, and you see Vicente Fox kneeling and kissing the ring of the Pope. So the church has made a great comeback in Mexico now, and some Mexicans are unhappy and some are very pleased.
We're really at the time we have to finish. Can you, in a minute, and I'm sorry to do that to you, but talk a little bit about the future of the relationship between Mexico and the United States?
Yes, difficult. The United States exploits Mexico. We ship corn there, for example, that's subsidized, and we undercut the prices of poor Mexican farmers, so we're destroying Mexican agriculture. There's a great tension. I think that the United States must find some way to accommodate the immigration from Mexico. Great numbers of undocumented people will continue to come here because of the Mexican economic situation. And we must learn, to welcome them, I think. They're very young, generally. They bring great youth and energy to a society that's aging, to the United States. We'll have to do something to help the Mexican economy. That's probably the only way to slow down this immigration. And Mexico will have to continue to see people emigrate because there are more than a million Mexicans being born every year, and Mexico can't create anything like a million decent jobs a year.
I'm sorry to cut in. You know, we're just going to have to stop. The book is The Life and Times of Mexico, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest Earl Shores. And Mr. Shores, thank you very much for talking
to us. Well, it's been great fun.